This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
A million, million people are happy, bright, and gay. Bright and gay, the bells are ringing in the steeple. It's a public holiday.
Hi there, nice to be with you. Happy you could stick around. Like to introduce Legs Larry Smith, drums. And Sam Spoons, rhythm pole. And Vern Dudley Bohay Noel, bass guitar. And Neil Innes, piano. Come in, Rodney Slater, alto saxophone. With Roger Ruskin Spear on tenor sax. Hi, Vivian Stanchel, trumpet. Big hello to Big John Wayne, xylophone. And Robert Morley, guitar. Billy Butlin, spoons. And looking very relaxed, Adolf Hitler on vibes. Nice. Princess Anne on sousaphone. Introducing Liberace, clarinet. With Garner Ted Armstrong on vocals. Lord Snooty and his pals tap dancing. In the groove with Harold Wilson, violin. And Franklin McCormack on harmonica. Over there, Eric Clapton, ukulele. Hi, Eric. On my left, Sir Kenneth Clark, bass sax. Great honor, sir. Especially flown in for us, a Sessions Gorilla on Vox Humana. Nice to see Incredible Shrinking Man on euphonium. Drop out with Peter Scott on Duck Call. Hearing from you later, Casanova, on Horn. Yeah, digging General DeGaulle on accordion. Really wild, General. Thank you, sir. Roy Rogers on trigger. Tune in Wild Man of Borneo on bongos. Count Basie Orchestra on triangle. Thank you. Great to hear the Rawlinsons on trombone. Back from his recent operation, Dan Drop, hot. And representing the flower people, Quasimodo on bells. Wonderful to hear Brainiac on banjo. We welcome Baldunikin himself. Very appealing Max Jaffa. That's nice, Max. What a team, Zebra Kit and Horace Batchelor on percussion. And a great favorite and a wonderful performer, all of us here, J. Arthur Rank on gong.
Oh, you're throwing to me. What's that?
That would be throwing to me. I'm sorry.
Indeed.
That was the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band. And what we just heard was the intro and the outro, which was, I believe, used as an intro and an outro by a number of people here at the station for a number of years and is still extremely funny. And before that, I have to find the box because we...
Who here at the station used that as outro music? I remember you played it once before.
I played it, but I know that like somebody at KBFK played it all the time. It's where I first heard it.
That's not the station, though.
Well, it's Pacific Station,
that's true.
Isn't it?
And is Pacific Station.
I think Freund played it. I think Jim Freund used it because it is intro music. And you know, you know what? I'm sure I'm gonna get an email from him.
And that really was Eric Clapton on the ukulele.
Absolutely. The Bonzo Dog Band was just an amazing comedy band from the 60s when you had like amazing musicians in amazing comedy bands, and it's not like you don't find that today. Kind of like the Mothers of Invention, except they were in England. And as with the Mothers of Invention, they really were amazing musicians and had amazing friends. And in the case of the Bonzo Dog Band, they had friends in the Beatles. And if you have seen, those of you who have seen the not Sergeant Pepper, what's the other one? The
Yellow Submarine?
No.
Magical Mystery Tour?
Magical Mystery Tour. Have you seen the movie Magical Mystery Tour?
I never did.
Well, if you had, you would have seen Neil Innes from the Bonzo Dog Band, and you would have seen Vivian Stanshall from the Bonzo Dog Band, and you would have seen a number of other people doing things in this movie.
So what year
And Neil Innes remained friends with well, with Paul McCartney, but also with George Harrison, and with he was friends with other folks in Monty Python. And if you saw anything involving the Ruddles, that's Neil Innes, and Neil Innes was in the Bonzo Dog Band.
Well, okay, was he a Ruddle?
He was a Ruddle.
Oh yeah.
Oh, he absolutely was a Ruddle.
Ruddle?
He was a crucial Ruddle. He was the keyboards playing Ruddle.
Uh-huh.
He was one of the songwriting Ruddles, really, more to the point. Mm. That he was one of the creative figures behind
was Ruddles. He one of the performing Ruddles? One of the,
yes.
One of the four?
Yeah.
Uh-huh, okay. One of the full four, I guess it would be. So what year was that recorded that we just listened to, more or less?
I think 1967.
Uh-huh.
I mean,
wow, really?
The thing is, you know what? Pogo, because now that we have these like little tiny like CDs instead of great big records, and you have people like me that whose eyes are not as good as they were when they were younger, it's really hard for me to look at this little tiny CD and tell you exactly when it was recorded. But when we go to later in the evening and we play other things, and I can look at this and I can tell you exactly when it was recorded. But I could tell you just off the top of my head, and I think it's about 1967, because I know this is off their first release, and that was around 1966, 1967. And around that time, you started hearing it everywhere on community radio and different kinds of things like Pacifica Radio. I heard it on, as I said, on KPFK in Los Angeles, but I also could have heard it on other things. And if you lived anywhere, I believe, in the United States where people had control of their own radio, then they would have played this for you because it was so funny. I mean, and still to this day, even when I hear the word vibes, I always hear, and introducing Adolf Hitler and vibes, very relaxed. I mean, it's still that's one of those things that just sticks with you. I mean, it really does. I always remember Adolf Hitler and vibes. And also, I think one of the things that happened with the Bonzo Dog Band is sort of similar to what happened with Monty Python, is that I think they had a certain kind of fandom in the United States that was completely unrelated to the kind of fandom that they even might have had in the UK, which was that people who were kind of in love with the UK without knowing that much about it. And as with Monty Python. With Monty Python, that when people looked up and did ethnic accents, they just often sounded like funny voices to people in the United States. They were aware that probably they were ethnic accents and they were supposed to know what they were, but they didn't know what they were. And they enjoyed them just as much anyway, perhaps more because there was no possibility of their being offended by a hostile ethnic accent because they didn't know what it was in the first place. And
well, when you say ethnic, I guess you mean Cockney.
No, that's the point. Everyone in the United States, including me and you, I mean, we could probably recognize an Irish accent, a Scots accent, although we'd be probably hard-pressed to tell it from a Welsh or, you know, whatever accent.
Well, the
thing is, they had like North. There's many, many different kinds of accents in the UK as there are in the United States. Mm-hmm. Probably many, many more, if anything. And so they would have people from the, you know, different parts of the North of England, from Manchester and Birmingham and all this kind of stuff, or from different parts of Wales, from different parts of Scotland, from different parts of Ireland. And if you lived over there, you would know immediately who these people were just from listening to them. But
so I'm displaying my own American cluelessness by assuming that it's all Cockney, in other words.
Right, as I was, because I would hear something and I would recognize it as some kind of like dropping the H's, you know, English accent, and that I recognized as an English accent. And then I also recognized the kind of posh BBC accent. But those were the two that I recognized. And I would believe, the third one that everybody in the United States knows is the Liverpool accent, because the Beatles had
it.
And so there are three accents that everyone in the United States is familiar with. And the other ones are all like a complete wash. And it's sort of like in the United States that you can have like a lot of jokes about New Jersey or Staten Island or whatever. And people here will know what they are. But outside of the United States, it's not sort of clear why New Jersey is funnier than, you know, Maine. Right? And even in the United States, I might add, it's not really clear why New Jersey is funnier than Maine, except that we all know that there is a history behind thinking that it is. And you might have your opinion about why this might be funny or why it might be appropriate to make a joke about it. And a lot of the stuff that was true in the UK around that stuff was just completely new to the United States. I mean, we might know that even once somebody said what I just said to you, and even me saying it now, I mean, I know that there's something I should be catching about it. And the thing is, I still don't. If you could show me these shows now, I still say, well, gee, that certainly seems to be some kind of, like, accent from the West Country. I wonder what it is, you know. I wonder what particular, like, you know, cliche about people from the West Country I'm seeing here. And the thing is, we never knew what it was. In the United States, you just saw it as funny, another funny English thing. And I think that's one of the reasons why it was even bigger in the UK than it was here, because it was so weird. You know, every last, you know, cliche was funnier than the last one here because we just recognized them as foreign. And the other thing I think that was very big in the United States as opposed to the UK was men dressed up in skirts. Is the whole thing of men in dresses. In here, in the United States, this, at one point, and I really, really earlier in our time period, I would say well into the 19th century, we had the same traditions of men in community theater dressed up in skirts, and this being just sort of a part of the regular something you would expect to see in the theater. The sort of one of the last gasps of it is, in fact, whatever this thing is with the press corps where they make the mayor dress up in a dress, you know, what every regime that the mayor has to prove that he's willing to get dressed up in a dress, otherwise he's just not going to be able to continue to rule the city.
He's a stick in the mud,
and he's beyond a stick in the mud. He's not even a man. Because if he were a real man, he'd be willing to get up in a dress and prance around in front of the press corps like every other mayor since, you know, Jimmy Walker, whoever it is, that's, you know, that has been doing this. And this is something that has a really long history in the UK, but it's just kind of died out in the US. And all the guys in Monty Python had done it at Oxford or Cambridge or wherever they went to school, because it's still a part of the burlesque, you know, performances that they do in school there. And I believe it's still part of television there. It's still part of the movies. Oh, God, another one of the things. One of the things that I have been watching the last, oh, 4 or 5 years is, what do you call this? It's a man in a dress thing that has had a big deal in England that had no play in the United States. But he's in a Bowery Boys comedy that involved Bela Lugosi. So everybody has seen that particular one.
I know not of what you speak.
I know. I'm going to have to ask Max about it because I can't remember the guy's name. But he was an Irish guy who played an Irish washerwoman for a series of comedies that went on for about 20 years. And
the 20 years would have been? Like
from, you know, the 20s to the 50s.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I think it basically comes out of the time period where women were not allowed on the English stage. And, you know, women began being allowed on the English stage in the 18th century, but because this has sort of been established as some kind of tradition, that it remained as sort of a popular tradition even as it died out as any kind of requirement, as not just a legal tradition, but as anything you do in the legitimate stage. And
yet there's these weird survivals of it.
And yet there's these weird survivals of it. And I got interested in it mostly because of watching professional wrestling, where I see the same thing going on. Because professional wrestling is also a form of, like, popular theater that goes on independent of what anybody thinks of it and has its own traditions, and which, you know, go on independent of what anybody thinks of them outside of professional wrestling. And that's what sort of began to get me interested in seeing this when I recognized it in other places. But one of them was this thing with the old Mother Riley. Old Mother Riley meets the vampire. Old Mother Riley. That's what I was trying to think of. Old Mother Riley. He played this, and his name was Arthur Lacan. And so he played this character called Old Mother Riley, who was, you know, a maid. And as, you know, the servants generally are in comedies, she's the smartest person in the comedy. You know, even though she's the person who makes the least money and supposedly is the person that you would be making fun of, she's the only one who actually knows what's going on. And she's played by this guy. And the other thing that makes it funny in the comedies, especially if you know this, is that she's often trying to sort of negotiate a wedding with her daughter. And her daughter in the movies is played by the guy's wife in real life, who was like 30 years younger than him and with whom he had a rather combative relationship. But aside, you know, it would be equally funny even if they got along really well. I mean, the interesting part is that you would have like a very, very large audience for a movie where you had, you know, a guy dressed up like a woman playing a comedy role where she was, you know, playing sort of like a Lucille Ball kind of character, which is basically what she's doing. And as Max pointed out, they had one American, you know, outing, which is where she played with the Bowery Boys in Bela Lugosi. You know, Old Mother Riley meets a Brooklyn vampire. And that's the only one that most people here have seen. It's certainly the only...
Bela Lugosi played the vampire, I assume.
You know, the thing, I think actually somebody else played it.
Oh, yeah.
Although, if I'm wrong on that, I'm sure Max will run it again and tell me that I'm wrong. But I saw one other outing in this actually on TCM like about 2 years ago, around the time when I got interested in it. And it's just amazing to know that you had this huge, huge interest in this subject. And on this guy's gravestone in England, they have a very, very long flowery, you know, sentiment with the idea that, like, children of all ages are going to forever, you know, hold this guy in high regard. And, you know, no one outside of England has ever heard of him at all, outside of this, you know, this Bela Lugosi Bowery Boys movie. And even now, my guess would be in England that he's not, you know, as well remembered as he would have been in the 50s. And it's just interesting to see that the kinds of societal assumptions that we believe are going to be eternal are not very eternal, that they barely will last a generation or two. You know, we think that, like, oh, we see this and everybody will get why it is funny. Well, no, they won't. You know, even maybe your kids won't get why it's funny. Certainly your grandkids are probably going to have it explained to them. And yeah, it's just sort of a funny thing. And I don't even know how I got onto that particular rant, except I guess I can be pushed onto a rant of that kind with no push at all. Certainly I can't say that Bill here, like, made me say all this stuff. No, I just went on and on and on and on of my own accord.
Oh, so the implication is that this is not what the show is about then.
It is what the show is about. Oh, I mean, okay. The show is about whatever, you know, we start talking about,
well,
right?
That's true.
I mean,
thus far, it's what the show is about.
Thus far. Well, and I guess because it's this much of the show, this is part of what the show is about. I mean, I guess we can get it back onto some kind of track if we feel that there is a track it should be on. In fact, because it's a trackless show, and really it's why I felt, you know, that I felt able to just go on to, like, you know, on this 15-minute thing about something that is actually very much on my mind much of the time when I'm reading and when I'm seeing movies and when I listen to radio shows and listen to music. It's because I really was planning to do a review of a book, and I'm going to do it now, but I was expecting to do a different kind of review of it, and it's a review of a book I really was looking forward to reading, by Roberto Bolano, called The Savage Detectives. Now, Roberto Bolano has an enormous reputation in Spanish literature. He died, I think, in 2003. And I have never read anything by him until recently, when several of his things were translated. And this particular book was translated last year, and the year before that it won a number of awards, and a bunch of his things have gotten translated into English. And everyone who reads Spanish-American literature says this is the guy, you know, that everyone is impressed by and that you should read, and that, you know, you're going to want to check him out because you want to see what everybody is reading. And so I picked up this book with the most excitement. I really did. I mean, I was going to read it. And I still, well, I guess you're picking up, I didn't like this book, but not in the usual way of not liking a book. When I review fiction on the show, I mean, I have not been on the show for a while, but when I was on the show and I was reviewing fiction on a regular basis, there were certain kinds of bad reviews I just never did. One was, you know, somebody who wrote a bad book that was for a small press that I knew wasn't going to sell anything. Why go and pee on their grave? You know, I mean, I never bothered to do that. And then there was the kind of book that was sort of a really good book, but it was really sort of more like an exalted YA novel. You know, it was like, you know, you'd had fun while you read it, but that was about it. And it wasn't poorly written, you know, but it was, you know, the writing didn't get in the way, but it wasn't really like a great book or anything. But you would have a good time when you read it. And I wouldn't usually bother, you know, to piss on a book like that either. Generally, the only kind of book that I would read if I didn't like it, and still I feel that this is the way to go, is if I feel that there's something really pernicious about it. Like I think that it's actually going to start a new race war or something like that. Then I'll feel that I really, really should say something about it. And this book, let me give you another example. Probably the worst novel I read in the last year was a book called Special Topics in Calamity Physics by a woman named Marisa Peschel, I don't know how you pronounce her name, and which just got fantastic reviews. And I like fiction, and I'm always interested in fiction by women, and particularly, you know, first novels. I'm willing to take a risk and, you know, go and, you know, see what they're doing. And I just felt this was like a lot of things that I read. It was sort of like the kind of thing that normally I would read and, you know, say, okay, and not give a bad review to, you know, a YA, basically an exalted kind of YA novel, you know, a teenage novel, in other words. And it reminded me a lot of a book called, what's it called? The Secret History by Donna Tartt, where there's sort of a murder mystery, you know, involving a bunch of college students. And, but it added onto that a lot of kind of useless, gimmicky ending techniques and things with other books. And I just felt that I could not understand why this was getting, like, these tremendous reviews. And the more I read it, the more I got irritated, because I felt that as a good YA novel would have been done in 200 pages. And yet it sort of bloated on to 500 pages and had no real reason for it. But I also felt that maybe this, like, girl would write a better book in the future. So that's an example of a bad kind of book, a book that I felt, you know, it got good reviews, but I didn't like it. And I felt, while I was reading it, that it was a bad book. And then we have the book that I'm going to review now, which is The Savage Detectives by Roberto Bolaño. Now, Bolaño, I think his name is. He's Chilean. This book just threw me completely. This got the best reviews of anything that was published in English over maybe, you know, the last year and a half. And I had heard of this guy before, and most of his stuff had not been published in English, and I was very, very looking forward to it. And as I read it, I just felt buffaloed by it, you know, and not in the sense of, as I was saying with this Marisa Peschel book, like, wow, everybody thinks this is a great book, and I can see, man, this just doesn't seem like a great book to me. That's not the reaction I had to this. I just felt like everybody thinks this is a great book, and I'm not reacting to it like a great book. And I don't think the problem was the book. I think the problem was with me. And I don't think I've ever reviewed a book like this on the air. But, I mean, I put this forward to you who are listening. I'm sure some of you have read it. A lot of the book, especially in the beginning, is kind of goofing on other writers. And a lot of the writers are not well known to English-speaking readers. In some cases, in a lot of cases, I believe they have never been translated into English. And even the ones that have are not, in many cases, people that I have read. So when you're making jokes about them, I don't get the jokes. So I felt, I was so bothered by this when I was reading the first 200 pages or so of that, I actually did something I never do, which is I went online and started looking for reviews of it. And I always feel that that is cheating in a really serious way. I was really raised to not do a couple of things. One is, you know, you don't raise your voice at home. And the other one is you don't use secondary sources. And I just felt that if I was going to review this on the air, at least I had to get some kind of footing with it. You know, I just felt like I was, it's not that I didn't like the book. I just felt like I'm just not getting this book. This book really requires a kind of getting, you know, I should be having like a kind of aha reaction to this stuff. I can tell by just reading it, I should be having that reaction. I'm not having it. I'm feeling like, oh, wow, who are these people? In fact, it took me, like, I was, like, probably 50 pages into it before I realized that he was, that the people that he was making reference to were real people. I thought it was, like, Bortus. I thought he was making them up. I thought, I just thought that he was coming up with, like, lists of literary figures that, you know, were some in some kind of imaginary library of his
own. So who are the real people he refers to?
Well, they're, you know, like Cesar Vallejo and Leonora Carrington and people that I really love. But I'm saying there's a list of other people. And I, you know, I could give you a list of 75 people, you know, that I'd never heard of. I could also give you a list of 50 people that I have. But in a way, that's not the point. The point is that I even read an interview with a translator of the book who said that she didn't know who. She was not familiar with all the writers that the guy was referencing, but she thought the book was fun anyway. And that's when I realized I'm just not capable of having fun with this book because I can't do that. You know, I just can't. I feel like I'm faking. You know, it's like laughing at a, you know, you're in a room and everybody's laughing at a joke and everybody wants you to go along with it because they all think it's funny. It's not a case of being nice. I just feel like an a-hole, you know, if I laugh at a joke when I don't actually know why it's funny. It's just more honest to say I can see why it might be funny. I'm not saying it couldn't be funny. I'm saying that I don't understand why it's funny, and I feel like I'm a jerk if I sit here and pretend to you that I understand why I think this is.
So it is, in fact, a detective novel?
Well, kind of. It's a book about... The thing that I like, the stuff that I like the best is mostly at the beginning of the book, is that it's a book about a group of young people who form a literary movement and then other people's reactions to them and kind of what happens to them over a long period of time. It starts in the late 60s and goes up until almost the present time and has ultimately a really sad ending, you know. And sort of, again, because of the way it's written, I didn't, in a way, have a really... strong emotional reaction to it, and I felt like that there was something wrong about that too, although I felt that the book kind of didn't allow me to have an emotional reaction to it. And I feel, again, maybe I think this is a problem with me rather than the book. And some of the stuff I liked at the beginning is the guy, he posits the invention of a group called the Visceral Realists, who apparently are based much on a group that he was actually involved in the early 70s, called the Infra Realists. And that part of it I thought was hysterically funny, which was because it was very much like reading about the Dadaists and the Surrealists and the Situationists, in the sense of sort of grasping onto people for no particular good reason and then throwing them out again for no particularly good reason. And one of the funniest parts is when a guy that has been sort of drawn in because basically, like, he hit it off with them, but not because he had any real poetic talent, is informed that they've thrown out all the female members of the group. And he can't even though he knows it's a total loser thing to say and it might lead to him being thrown out of the group, he can't stop himself from saying, "How could you throw out all the women?" Because, of course, part of the point when you're, like, you know, 19 or 20 and having a group is, you know, you have to have women in it because
For
obvious reasons, yes. You've got to have women in it. And so it's just funny, you know, that even though they're going to throw out people for no really good reason because they think they're not very good poets, that he still thinks, although they might not be very good poets, that they ought to have kept the women in for obvious reasons. And, I mean, it starts out with simple things like that, and it becomes more complicated as the book goes along. But as I said, I mean, I didn't quite... I always felt like I was sort of swimming in the deep end of the pool, and I don't generally have that the reaction to a book. I would be really... I'd be grateful. In fact, if anybody who's listening is a better reader of this than I am, and they want to write us a postcard or a letter and explain to me what it was that they got out of the book and why they thought it was a wonderful book, I would love if you would tell it to me. Because, as I said, it's not like I'm saying that I think the upper has no clothes and everybody thinks this guy is a great writer and I think he's a jerk. I just genuinely feel like I'm missing something here, and I would like to have somebody explain it to me. There is one very funny part at the beginning of the book where he divides all Latin American poets into faggots and queers.
The distinction being what exactly?
Well, I'm not really quite sure, except that Whitman is a faggot and Octavio Paz is a queer. So I guess you can sort of guess from there which is which. But he goes on to a huge list of people, most of, as I said, I have not heard of. And then there are a few people that are absolute freaks, like, you know, Verlaine and Rimbaud. But in general, like, and it's very funny, it goes on for pages and pages. And so there's things like that that make me feel like if I just kind of was more on board with this, I really think this might be one of my favorite books, but it sort of can't be. And I can't pretend to you that I understand it better than I do, you know, so that it could be. I would like to read one thing from the middle of it, which is this character is the father of one of the female characters, one of the girls, in fact, that was the one of the women that was kicked out of the group, tragically, who has a breakdown through the course of the book and has to be put into a hospital. And then he gives his opinion about literature, which has been, in fact, quite important to him. The whole structure of this book is that you're hearing, you know, you sort of go from one person to another who is giving you their opinion about the people that you've heard about in the previous session, so that it's always, you're sort of piecing together what has actually happened for many, many different people's opinions of the people and opinions of the text itself. Joaquin Font, a repulsive mental health clinic. Camino Desierto de Las Siones, on the outskirts of Mexico City, January 1977. There are books for when you're bored, plenty of them. There are books for when you're calm, the best kind, in my opinion. There are also books for when you're sad, and there are books for when you're happy. There are books for when you're thirsty for knowledge, and there are books for when you're desperate. The latter are the kind of books that Ulysses Lima and Arturo Bolano wanted to write. Ulysses Lima and Arturo Bolano are the main characters in this book that are starting the art movement.
Presumably autobiographical, somewhat based on himself?
Arturo Bolano.
Similar name.
That's basically, I think, meant to be him. A common mistake, a serious mistake, as we'll soon see. Let's take, for example, an average reader, a cool-headed, mature, educated man leading a more or less healthy life, a man who buys books and literary magazines. So there you have him. This man could read things that are written for when you're calm, but he can also read other things, of other kinds of books, with a critical eye, dispassionately, without absurd or regrettable complicity. That's how I see it. I hope I'm not offending anyone. Now, let's take the desperate reader, who's presumably the audience for the literature of desperation. What do we see? First, the reader is an adolescent or an immature adult. Insecure, all nerves. He's the kind of effing idiot, pardon my language, who committed suicide after reading Werther. And second, he's a limited reader. Why limited? That's easy, because he can only read the literature of desperation or books for the desperate, which amounts to the same thing. The kind of person or freak who's unable to read all the way through In Search of Lost Time, for example, or The Magic Mountain. A paradigm of calm, serene, complete literature, in my humble opinion. Or for that matter, Les Miserables or War and Peace. Am I making myself clear? Good. So I talked to them, warned them, alerted them to the dangers that they were facing. It was like talking to a wall. Furthermore, desperate readers are like the California gold mine. Sooner or later, they're exhausted. Why? It's obvious. One can't live one's whole life in desperation. In the end, the body rebels. The pain becomes unbearable. Lucidity gushes out in great cold spurts. The desperate reader, and especially the desperate poetry reader, who is insufferable, believe me, ends up by turning away from books. Inevitably, he ends up becoming just plain desperate. Or he's cured. And then, as part of the regenerative process, he returns slowly, as if wrapped in swaddling clothes, as if under a rain of dissolved sedatives. He returns, as I was saying, to a literature written for cool, serene readers, with their heads set firmly on their shoulders. This is what's called to me, if nobody else, the passage from adolescence to adulthood. And by that, I don't mean that once someone has become a cool-headed reader, he no longer reads books written for desperate readers. Of course he reads them, especially if they're good or decent or recommended by a friend. But ultimately, they bore him. Ultimately, that literature of resentment, full of sharp instruments and lynched messiahs, doesn't pierce his heart the way a calm page, a carefully thought-out page, a technically perfect page does. I told them so. I warned them. I showed them the technically perfect page. I alerted them to the dangers. Don't exhaust the vein. Humility. Seek oneself. Lose oneself in strange lands. But with the guiding line, with the breadcrumbs or white pebbles, and yet I was mad, driven mad by them, by my daughters, by Lord Damian, and so they didn't listen. Part of my problem with this book is I feel that when I reached the end of this book, I was only reading it sort of in a rather calm, measured kind of way because I was so at sea with it. And I felt it was something that probably more appropriately would have required a more desperate kind of reader. But if I had been a more desperate kind of reader, I couldn't have read it at all. And that has to be my final, my provisional reading of this book, that I felt like this book defeated me. I usually don't feel that about books generally. I certainly don't feel that about fiction, but I felt that about this book. And as I said, I felt that the problem is not with the book, but with me. I really generally would appreciate hearing from anyone who felt differently about it, who did read this book and who was more familiar with this writer, who is Roberto Bolaño, and the book was The Savage Detectives. He's written a number of other books as well, and if you can clue me into a little more about him, I would greatly appreciate it. You can write to us here at the station at the Moorish Orthodox Word of Crusade at WBAI here at 120 Wall Street, and I'll be thrilled, totally thrilled to hear from you.
Now, this was published posthumously?
Yeah, he died in 2003.
Mm-hmm. He died in 2003, and the book was written...
He had a giant reputation in Latin America before that time. Mm-hmm. But I don't know why more of his stuff was not published while he was in English while he's still alive, but it was not.
So was it just recently translated into English, and it was already successful in Latin America?
Oh, yeah, about a year ago.
Oh, gotcha. Mm-hmm.
It won a ton of awards in Latin America in Spanish.
And why detectives?
Because they're trying to find out the facts of a series of deaths. And
all right, so it actually is. It actually does have a sort of murder mystery element to it.
Somewhat. Mm-hmm. Somewhat. There is somewhat of a murder mystery element to it. There certainly is a mystery element to it, and there is an element of a mystery of how the people died, whether it's exactly like a whodunit kind of thing. No, not exactly. But how people died, what it meant, and how they got to where they are. But as I said, I had a certain detached feeling about it when I was reading it, and I couldn't feel I felt that the book kind of required that of me, but I had an also feeling from reading other things in the book that that wasn't the appropriate response. So I felt confused while reading the book. And I would, as I said, I would love to hear from someone else that another approach that would help me to appreciate this guy more or something. I'd just like to know more. I would like to hear from other people who know more about this writer than I do. I guess that's what I'm really trying to say. Because I've heard how great he is without really kind of understanding why he is as great as he is. But even the stuff that I have read, I liked it enough to feel that there was a lot there, but I felt that I was not understanding it. That's it.
Okay. Should we hear more Bonzo Dog Band? Or?
Yeah, I guess.
Or do you have another book review?
Well, I do, but you know what? Let's just hear, you know. It'd probably be better to hear more of the Bonzo Dog Band. What's the thing you have? What's the number of the...
What, the number of the CD? The number of the disc?
No. I mean, I'm sorry. I'm just so blind. I can't read my own CDs over here.
Dada is normal. Normal is nice. The Bonzo Dog Band Cornology.
I know. It's a...
Disc one.
Disc one.
Manufactured in England.
I'm sorry, I'm just an idiot. Four.
Okay, four it
four.
Is.
It's her four. It will be our salute to the Emmys.
Okay.
The loveliness of Paris seems somehow sadly gay.
Thank you very much. You're really wonderful. I'm very lucky for us this time.
The glory that was Rome is of another day. I've been terribly alone and forgotten in Manhattan. I'm going back to my city by the bay.
Was that the song, or did it,
no.
We have a malfunction?
There should be more.
A studio malfunction. That was cut four. Here, why don't we take it from the top? It's deja vu.
The loveliness of Paris seems somehow sadly gay.
Thank you very much. You're really wonderful. I'm very lucky for us this time.
The glory that was Rome is of another day. I've been terribly alone and forgotten in Manhattan. I'm going back to my city by the bay.
And 3, 4.
Unmarried, looking for love, life was passing me by. So I sent off my photo, hobbies and age, magazine marriage I'd try. They say for centuries lovely Japanese girls have been trained in the art of pleasing men. Be lonely no more, open destiny's door. For $1 they arrange a meeting. My image was wrong, I didn't like me, so I changed my personality. I bought a deluxe Mersey Beach wig, but it was a size too big. What confidence in my new built-up shoes, so smart for winter or summer, undetectable in normal everyday use. Look out, there's a monster coming. Bye-bye binoculars and Macintosh, everything is just great. I take elocution, learn to speak posh, but still I can't find a mate. Be popular, learn to play the guitar, in 7 days you could be strumming. Be sociable, learn kissing technique, look out, there's a monster coming. My canabi clothes, I reshape my nose, plastic surgery's best. To cut down my weight, off comes my left leg, I pass the swimming costume test. On my sideboard, through long road, my aftershave pong, I know my nude nose ain't running. What's wrong with my tie, am I getting too high? Look out, there's a monster coming. Disfiguring ugly, my facial hair, I had removed electrically. I rejuvenated my energy cells and regained my virility. Grunt, grunt, he put my hand on my heart, I ain't changed any part. He had a machine for a mummy. Please be gentle with me, I come to pieces, literally. Look out, there's a monster coming. 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 Look out, there's a monster coming.
Excuse me. So, Anne-Marie, what were we just listening to there? More Bonzo Dog Band.
That was more Bonzo Dog Band. That was I Left My Heart in San Francisco, which was our Emmy tribute because, of course, Tony Bennett won a ton of them for no really good reason except that he's old. Well, he is a very nice guy, you know, and deserves a lot of things, and it's too bad that nobody ever wins an award until they're, like, quite old. But we listened to that, and the follow-up song, Look Out, There's a Monster Coming. Actually, Tony Bennett actually came to the library I worked in, that I work in about a month ago, and it was, you know, he was just sort of killing time while he was waiting to meet his daughter, apparently. And the really sad thing was he immediately ran into what we who work in the library deal with all day long, which is nuts, you know. He dealt with some guy who's, like, been writing, you know, one of these guys who's writing a book that, you know, he's been writing a book for 30 years that, you know, maybe,
sounds,
I don't know, maybe.
Sounds like me.
Well, but you've actually published a couple of books. And maybe I'm wrong. Maybe this guy actually will get this book published. But he just, like, glommed on to Tony, and he would not let him go. And he just, like, kept, he started, like, showing his notes to him and taking them out of his bag. And he was trying to hand him a disc, you know, that he could download to see this guy's tremendous work. And finally we managed to, like, you know. And he was so gracious and so kind with him. That was really the sad part. I mean, I really could see what a... He was so nice to the guy. I mean, he really was. He was much nicer than I would have been. And I realized this is why Tony Bennett is an American treasure and I'm not. Because he was, as I said, he was really a kind, you know, gracious listener. You know, he just, like, no matter, like, what the nonsense this guy was spouting on him, he just kept nodding his head and saying, "That's amazing." As though he really thought it were.
Speaking of which, we may take listener phone calls, right?
Exactly. If only Tony Bennett were here. He'd be a kinder and more gracious listener than I'm likely to be. Yes.
Anyway, can I read a few announcements? I brought some announcements.
Please do.
That's really all I came here to do, apart from kibitz a little with you and engineer and
things.
Things. But I've got a couple of announcements. There's a couple of Times Up-related events which are happening this week, one of which is going to be a very interesting film. It's going to be at the Times Up space this Thursday, September 20th, entitled Birdsong and Coffee, A Wake-Up Call, which is about the... do you know what the one country in Central America which has held out against CAFTA and refused to ratify the Central American Free Trade Agreement?
No.
Is Costa Rica.
Huh.
Of all things. Because, I mean, Costa Rica, you know, is kind of, you know...
So full of Americans.
Exactly. It's so yeah. It's perceived as being very Americanized right. and very capitalist and prosperous and globalized and blah, blah, blah.
But yet,
you know, it's kind of got this progressive tradition, not, you know, a real hardcore left nationalist tradition like, you know, exists in Nicaragua, which, by the way, you know, has, I mean, now I think...
Caved.
With Ortega back in power, you know, they're trying to get out of CAFTA, but they had already signed on to it. They'd already ratified it by the time he took power. But Costa Rica is holding out. And they're very concerned. One of the reasons they're holding out is because they're concerned about the ecological impacts, and ecotourism is a big deal there. So Costa Rica's workers, farmers, wildlife, and ecosystems are threatened by the adoption of the Central American Free Trade Agreement. People of Costa Rica fiercely opposed this disastrous trade deal, making it politically impossible for the Costa Rican government to ratify the deal in its legislature. In early October, the agreement will be brought to an historic popular referendum. This was a real victory of the popular movements in Costa Rica. It's actually going to be put to a popular vote, which it has not been in any of the other Central American countries. Will Costa Rica cave under pressure from the U.S., or will the majority vote no to CAFTA and drive a nail into the coffin of NAFTA-style trade deals? In this forum, we will also explore the devastating impacts of corporate agribusiness in the coffee trade and look at fair trade, organic, and bird-friendly alternatives. So basically what they're worried about is the expansion of coffee and cattle ranching and agribusiness generally into rainforest lands and the displacement of campesinos from their traditional lands eating into the rainforest and so on. And they've got this very progressive national park system in
right.
Costa Rica. And it would appear to be threatened. So this is going to be, I believe, a screening of the feature film Birdsong and Coffee, A Wake-Up Call, as well as... a panel featuring Phil Jocelyn of the Committee in Solidarity with the People of El Salvador, CISPIS, Leonard Marine of the New York City People's Referendum on Free Trade, and Martha Howes of the Movement for Peace in Colombia. So this looks really interesting, and I'm going to be there. This is going to be this Thursday, September 20th, 8 p.m., at the Times Up space, and the Times Up space is 49 East Houston Street between Mott and Mulberry. Once again,
that's interesting.
This Thursday, 8 p.m. at the Times Up space, 49 East Houston. Now, there's another Times Up event which is going to be happening. It's actually having the opportunity to announce it again next week, if in fact I'm here next week. Because it's going to be happening a week from this Friday, September 28th, which is going to be the they've actually been around, if you can believe it, for 20 years now. Time's Up has been around. And they're having their big 20th anniversary bash Friday, September 28th at 8 p.m. once again at the Time's Up space at 49 East Houston. There's a sliding scale, they say, between $10 and $1,000 at the door.
They should just say between $10 and $1 million.
It is a fundraiser. Well, they don't want to be elitist, you know. So,
well, what if somebody had $1 million and then they felt they couldn't give it because, you know.
I suppose. Well, there's going to be live music from Team Spider and Japanther. And
let's just say between $10 and $1 billion. That's what I would do.
There you go. Won't turn George Soros away. Come on in and shake your bones, George. So once again, you know, that's going to be on the 28th, which is a week from this Friday at the Times of Space.
That sounds like fun, too.
49 East Houston. But there's going to be another event which is happening that night. So you're going to have to choose between one and the other. And the other event is going to be the big War Resisters League awards ceremony entitled Taking on the Torturers, reception and presentation of the War Resisters League 2007 Peace Award to CCR, the Center for Constitutional Rights. And the TASSC, which is the Torture Abolition and Survivors Support Coalition. And these two groups, writes the War Resisters League, have gone toe-to-toe with those who believe in fighting terror with terror. Almost every year since 1958, the War Resisters League has given a peace award to a person or organization whose work represents the League's platform of radical nonviolent action. So this event is also going to be happening a week from Friday, September 28th, Taking on the Torturers, War Resisters League annual awards ceremony, where they're honoring the work of the Center for Constitutional Rights and the Torture Abolition and Survivors Support Coalition. And it is going to be happening 6 p.m. Friday, September 28th at the New York Society for Ethical Culture, 2 West 64th Street, just off of Central Park West. And this also looks like it's going to be a real important event. They're also asking about as much as you pay for a movie at the door, a little bit more than you pay for a movie. But that includes cocktails and champagne. So,
cocktails, all right.
There you go. 6 p.m. Friday, September 28th. At, you know, you could actually go to both. You could go to the...
I was going to say.
Exactly. You could go up to...
Not that far away from each other.
Well, they're both in Manhattan anyway. You can go up to Central Park West at the Ethical Culture Society and, you know, down a couple of cocktails with the War Resisters League and the Center for Constitutional Rights.
And then head on down.
And then head on down to the Time's Up space, exactly. So is there anything else which I need to announce?
We should say that it is 1:02 in the morning. You're listening to WBAI New York. 99.5 listener-sponsored radio.
And just because I'm not sure that I'm going
this
to...
And this is the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade.
Right.
Wow, I've almost forgot to say
and
it. Myself, Anne-Marie Hendrickson, and Bill Weinberg.
Yeah. And just because I'm not sure if I'm going to be here again, probably I will.
But just to
promote myself a little bit, just mark your calendar now on October 4th. I am going to be speaking, that's a Thursday, October 4th, I, Bill Weinberg, am going to be speaking on Building Solidarity with Iraq's Civil Resistance, a report back from the ZENCO conference.
That's so shocking, since you've never been associated with this cause in the past. I'm sorry, it's just funny, because you're always talking about it, that's why.
Well, yes, I suppose, I suppose a lot of the listeners out there sort of heard it all before, but... You know,
No, they haven't heard it all before. I just think it's...
Those of you who want to know even more and ask...
Exactly.
You can show up and ask me questions in person. Or if you vociferously disagree with me, you can show up and throw metaphorical tomatoes. Or if you really disagree with me, you can show up and throw literal tomatoes. So anyway, right, where is that going to be happening again? That's going to be happening...
Make sure they're ripe,
exactly.
Heirloom tomatoes.
Please make sure that they're ripe. Well, I don't know about heirloom tomatoes. You wouldn't
Come on. Good
waste
tomatoes.
Heirloom tomatoes.
Good tomatoes, something that we could use.
But yes, do make sure that they're ripe, exactly. Because if they're not ripe, you know, if you hit me in the eye, you could really hurt me. So
exactly.
Make sure they're ripe. So once again, that's going to be happening on October 4th, which is a Thursday at 7 p.m., at 44 East 32nd Street at the 11th floor. That's between Park and Madison. And it's brought to you by the New Space, the new school for pluralistic anti-capitalist education. So if you want more information, you can just check out the New Space website. And the best way to reach that is through our own website. Go to morc.info for Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. Go to the links page and click on the link for the New Space, and all that information will be right there. So that's it.
At your fingertips.
At your fingertips, so to speak. Exactly. So what do we do now? Do we play more Bonzo Dog Band? Do we take listener phone calls?
Well, we could play some Bonzo Dog Band and then take some listeners.
There you go. Sounds like a plan. Do we want to give the number? Oh, you know, I was just going to say, you know, I confess I haven't read it. I'm always very, very slow when it comes to getting around to reading fiction. But this I probably will at least look at. You know, Subcommander Marcos, one of our heroes of the Zapatistas.
He wrote a book?
He's written many books.
Well, he wrote a novel?
He wrote a detective novel.
Really?
Yes. You know, it's very interesting.
You have this book?
Yeah, I do, actually. It's out on loan to Chesley Hicks, who's going to be reviewing it for my website.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm. And when she returns it to me, I'll probably get around to reading it. but he co-wrote it with Ignacio Taibo, who is...
I know who he is.
Yeah, Mexico's, you know, best-selling detective novelist. Yeah, it's interesting that, you know, the sort of detective...
The Robert Parker of Mexico, sort of, yes.
Well, is he? I mean, the thing is, you know, the
something along that line, yes.
Detective novels in the U.S. generally sort of have a law and order right-wing kind of politics behind them.
Sometimes.
Often. Right?
Sometimes.
Well, he's not. He's like a radical left detective
novelist. Yeah, definitely. Right? Definitely. Yeah, definitely is.
And so what they did is, I mean, you know, Marcos is in some clandestine location down in the jungles of Chiapas. They alternated chapters, and they sent them back and forth through the mail. And that's how they wrote the book. And it's, you know, it's like the hot bestseller in Mexico at the moment.
That's funny.
Yes. And
not quite like an exquisite corpse, but yes.
And, you know, I should, what's the name of it again? Here, let me see if I can do a really quick web search and see if I can find here. Taibo Marcos. Will that do it? Here's a... The Uncomfortable Dead.
Hmm.
And it's somewhat autobiographical, but that is from Marcos's perspective. I mean, again, it's sort of even though it's crime fiction, it sort of interweaves with real life, and the actual Zapatistas are players in the book. So maybe if anybody has read either of these two books, The Uncomfortable Dead by Ignacio Taibo and Subcommander Marcos, or The Savage Detectives by Roberto Bolaño, and have something to say about either of these works,
tell me why I'm wrong.
Maybe they'll be inclined to call in at 212-209-2900 right after we hear a little bit more from the Bonzo Dog Band. What cut should we play?
14.
14 it is. 1, 2, 3, 14.
At the local dance, was passing by the door, a large effect would I come on the floor. Above the band, my voice was heard. Quite suddenly, it had occurred to me, I'm bored. With everything I touch and see, I'm bored. With exposés of LSD, I'm bored. With Frank Sinatra's new LP, and so I roar, I'm bored. Drinking different colored wines or beer,
chug-a-lug.
Just quite frankly leaves me bored of
tears for souvenirs.
And quite apart from what one hears, I've been like this for years and years, you see. Ennui,
I'm bored.
With Mother Nature or her son,
I'm bored.
With everything that should be done. And so, I just poke out my big red tongue and... I'm bored.
I'm tired of art.
Drawing bored.
Sex is a drag!
In a boarding house, I dare say.
Ha!
You mean they have bored Reginald Dantrol?
I'm bored to death!
Like mortar bored.
Bought by Cyril Ball.
I hate each Julie Andrews film they've made.
I'm just a nasty, narrow-minded jay. Don't think that I will smile at it. I'm not a weak-willed hypocrite, I'll say. I'm bored. I'm bored. With withered men and spotted tides who hum. Toss and tune like Edelweiss. I'm bored. But when I hear it in a trice, I shout. I'm bored. The only thing that ever interests me is me.
Me, 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 me.
Say!
How do you like that? They all have stage fright, Anne-Marie. Poor babies.
Life's like that, isn't it? Only the other day I was walking in the West End and suddenly I was set upon by hordes of fans and admirers who wanted to touch my clothes. So I took sanctuary in a nearby cinema. Normally, of course, I don't go in, but that day I saw something that really moved me. I'd like to share this wonderful experience with you. It was The Sound of Music.
Should we plunge into the unknown?
Well, see, the thing is, you've already lost a few people, but it's 212-209-2900. Well, now, see, we have to plunge into nothing, because now they all hung up. What's wrong with these people? They're not very...
Well, there's one person calling, but that's obviously going to be one of the terrible three, and I'm
no,
running out
not.
Of patience
you don't,
with them.
You don't know that at all.
I'll bet it is.
You don't know. 209-212-209-2900. It could be.
There's
it could
two.
Be, there's a. It's a big city. It could be.
There's anybody. Three. Okay, all three of them are trying now. I'm
it
holding up for one more. Want to bet? All right, let's go. Want to bet? WBAI, you're on the air. Now turn down the radio for starters. We don't need to listen to ourselves. Hello.
Hello.
Hi. Good night.
Bill, are you leaving the program?
I'm sorry.
Hello?
Hello.
Is this Bill Weinberg?
Yes.
Yeah. Did I misunderstand? Are you leaving the radio station?
He's on vacation. He needs a vacation.
I'm on semi-sabbatical, shall we say.
Oh, crumb. Why?
What, you're disappointed that I'm not leaving? Is that the implication?
I'm...
Turn down your radio, please.
Okay, all right. Yeah, go ahead.
No, she wants you to stay. She loves you.
Is that the implication? Which explanation is it? You're disappointed that I'm staying, or you're disappointed that I'm on sabbatical?
I'm disappointed that you're on sabbatical.
Oh, well, don't worry. Anne-Marie will keep you entertained.
I want you to stay.
Anne-Marie will keep you entertained, and maybe I'll...
She wants you.
Maybe I will feel refreshed after a few weeks, and...
Oh, you don't need a few weeks. You need like 6 days and come back next Tuesday.
I'll probably be here next Tuesday, but I'm just going to be kibitzing and engineering and reading announcements. Anne-Marie's in the driver's seat for a while.
Uh-huh.
But don't worry. She'll keep you entertained. I'm quite confident. Do stay tuned. Here, should we take another call?
Yeah.
All right. I'm just very disappointed. I hope you are able to come back.
Yeah.
See, she loves. See, they,
and be on the air, not just engineering.
See, they love you.
Yeah, okay.
All right, well, good to hear. Makes me feel good. Thank you.
Yeah, I really like you and your show.
Thank you very much.
Okay, bye-bye.
WBAI, you're on the air.
You know, I'm really shocked.
WBAI, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
Hey there. Well, I didn't read either book, but I do have some interesting, well, not interesting, but probably semi-pertinent stuff to say about the Bonzo Dog Band.
Great.
He was, Neil Innes was Ron Nasty. That's which one of the...
Oh, that's the Ruddle he
that
was.
That was the Ruddle
yes.
that he was.
And Ron Nasty was the pseudo-John?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. The pseudo-Lennon.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And he wrote a lot of the songs, I believe.
Oh, okay, great. Wrote, so to speak.
Him and Eric Idle.
One could call it writing, exactly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Of course you could call it writing.
And, well, I mean, some of those songs were very, very close to the Beatles
yeah.
songs they were ripping off.
But look how close they were. That's the point.
Oh, my,
I mean, you have to, so not everybody can do that.
My favorite is Get Up and Go.
You're right.
Like Get Back.
Yes, yes, yes.
And let's see. In Magical Mystery Tour, there's a part where everybody goes into a tent, and it's like a big hall. And they do there's like a striptease number being done, and that's the Bonzo Dog Band
right.
doing Death Cab for Cutie.
That's right.
And several bands have named themselves that.
Named themselves what?
Death Cab for Cutie.
There's
one particular one that is probably became most famous under that name, but yes, a lot of people have,
yes,
have liked that particular
first
name.
Album also.
That's a reference to a scene from Magical Mystery Tour?
From a song.
I think they had already done the song, but then they staged a version of it, I guess, for
right.
a movie.
That's pretty grim title for a movie, which is...
Well, it's the Elvis, that's the funnier, it's that it's sort of the Elvis parody song. That's like the...
Right, right. And I think that's the little twist in it.
Right.
They used to have lots of little, you know, like they were always giving you sound cue tricks.
Right.
That was supposed to relate to something.
You know, I never saw the movie. It's a huge gap in my cultural education, it really is.
I have it on Betamax, so you can
wow.
see
that.
But I haven't seen it in years, and, you know, everything is too expensive to buy nowadays.
So. But you have it on Beta, so you can watch it anytime.
No, because I don't have a Beta machine.
Oh.
I have like maybe 100 Beta tapes. All my best movies are on Beta. You know,
really?
That kind of stuff. But
so why don't you have a Beta player with all these Beta tapes?
Well, one of these days I'll have to get one. I had one, but it broke down.
Oh, okay, I see.
Yeah, you
That's
know,
the
they're
problem.
Like 30 okay. years old already, 35
the people
years old.
I knew that were really into this were people that, well, I know that the people who did the Grateful Dead show here, that all their stuff, oh, I shouldn't say all, but a really high percentage of their stuff was on Beta, because you could get a lot of information on a small amount of tape in Beta, apparently.
Yeah,
so they had hundreds of hours of stuff on like two or three Beta tapes.
Because at its slower speed,
right.
it's better than VHS. You know, in other words, VHS, if you shoot it at the fastest speed.
Right.
Whereas with Beta, you can get the same resolution, you know, with the slower speed.
That's what they tell me, yeah.
Yeah, and people used to shoot onto Beta when they did video.
Right.
And take it off Beta, because that was a better format. But, you know, we went...
So it goes, yeah.
Yeah, we went with VHS. So, is there anything else I was going to mention? Oh, yes, in Monty Python and the Holy Grail, when Bravely Brave Sir Robin is going through the woods and he's talking about getting, you know, all sorts of terrible things happening to him, the minstrel,
uh-huh.
that too is Neil Innes.
Right, right.
The minstrel.
The minstrel is Neil Innes,
yeah. Oh, okay.
Brave Sir Robin, mm-hmm. not afraid. Yes, that's Neil Innes, then. My guess is he probably wrote the musical.
Well, I'm getting a real cultural education tonight.
Yeah, and he was also, he traveled with Monty Python when they came in 1975.
Yes, he did.
He was
he,
on their
yes,
stage
he certainly did.
With Carol Cleveland.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I was always a big fan of the Bonzo Dog Band. And then a friend of mine met Neil Innes years mm-hmm. ago when he went to England because he was working with a performer. And he ran
Punch
into
him
Neil
in the
Innes,
eye.
And,
oh,
you know,
no,
it turns out he was a very good guy. He told him he had a friend that was raving about him, so he sent me an autographed picture. And,
oh, that's great.
You know, it was pretty neat. So, like I said, I'm sure that everything I know about them probably comes before the 80s or something.
What is he doing today? Do we know?
What are they doing?
What is Neil Innes doing today?
The last thing I heard about was that they had a Bonzo reunion, and there were several members of the band, you know, who are no longer with us. But there were also a number of people who sort of came to later prominence playing with other people, like the sax player on Dark Side of the Moon.
Right.
He's on Let's Make Up and Be Friendly, Dick Parry. And someone named Bubs White, who I think changed his name to Snowy White and was the second guitarist on the Pink Floyd tour.
Well, and also, isn't Neil Innes making just like a boatload of money off Spamalot?
Oh, is he behind that?
Well, because Spamalot is all the old Monty Python songs and stuff. And
which he wrote.
And he wrote some of them, didn't he?
I think he wrote Immanuel Kant, you know, Immanuel Kant,
right.
Real Fist, and it was very rarely stable. And some of that stuff.
And didn't he write some of the stuff on the Holy Grail?
Yes.
Monty Python Holy Grail? So,
yes.
I mean, like.
He wrote a lot of the music.
Right. So he must be. Some of that stuff is in the show, right?
Probably. That would be. I have never seen the show.
I have not either. But I since I love the band, I hope with all my heart that he's making a boatload of money.
I always thought that. You know, Americans needed something a little bit more like the Bonzo Dog Band, you know? I was thinking maybe they were like the Spike Joneses of England or something.
They kind of were. They were like the rock and roll Spike Joneses. And, you know, satire, like they say, is what closes on Saturday night. You know, you have to know too much about what the thing is that's being made fun of to understand why it's funny. And then if you do, you're mad because you don't think people should make fun of your favorite thing. So.
Well... It's kind of interesting because I think, as my English friends call it, you know, they take the piss out on something. That's kind of an English tradition.
I don't know, Men in a Dress. I know it's one of these things that doesn't
quite
play in the same way over here. Yeah.
So I'm not going to stay on much longer, but I was going to mention that maybe if you could find the song "Look at Me, I'm Wonderful."
Oh, it's on. I just have to find the disc. It's on.
I was thinking the American audience should definitely hear that, especially since you did the tribute to the Emmys. I was thinking that's like the reverse, the warning, as they call it.
Well, I will look for it while we're talking to other people, and I'm delighted that you called and that you know so much about the Bonzos. This is great.
Well,
the kind of call we're looking for, someone who can tell us something we don't know.
Radio crawl. I heard the intro and the outro, and I was like, I got to stop here. It turns out it was BAI. So another point for BAI. Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you and good night.
Thank you. WBAI, whoops, no, you're not on the air. There you go. Now you're on the air.
Yeah, quick question. Guys that dress up in women's clothes in Monty Python, I've heard they're part of the gay liberation movement.
I wish. I don't believe so. I mean, it's part of a much older tradition of just guys doing that. It's sort of... I mean, there were many queers who did it over the years at Cambridge and Oxford, but, I mean, it really just came out of a longer tradition of women not being allowed on the stage, and then even after they were, they kept doing it because they just did it.
Oh, okay. Well, that's what I heard from a friend a long time ago, but all right. Also, can you play We Are Normal and We Want Our Freedom? It's such a great tune.
I'll find it.
Okay, thanks. Bye.
Well, 3 people. 212-209-2900.
I'm looking for songs. You have to talk to these people.
Can we get 4? 212-209-2900. So, are you finding this cat's song? Wouldn't that be great if we could actually take requests? What was the name of the cut that he wanted? We Want Our Freedom, was that
We Are
it?
Normal, We Want Our Freedom, and Mr. Wonderful is the other one.
Maybe my eyes will do better. Maybe if we take another call, you can talk to them and I can look for the song.
No, you have to talk to them.
Oh, okay. So you're confident that your eyes will not fail you?
No, I'm not.
All right, now we've got 4. WBAI, you're on the air. Hello.
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 I have 2 questions for Anne Marie. How do you spell the last name of the author?
The one that I'm Buffalo
Savage
guy?
Savage Detective, yeah.
Roberto Bolano. B-O-L-A-N-O.
B-O-L-A-N-O.
But N with a tilde.
With a tilde, yeah.
Oh, Bolano. Okay. And the first name is?
Roberto.
Roberto. And does the New York Public Library have the book?
Absolutely.
Thank you very much.
WBAI, you're on the air. No, you're not. Why does that happen? Let's try again. You're on the air.
Blackwater.
Blackwater.
What?
WBAI, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to know when you're going to be holding a reunion show with Peter Lamborn Wilson and Sharon Gregory.
When they get back here.
Well, could you give some kind of an update? Have you been in touch with those folks recently, or are they doing anything interesting? Or
Sharon's around. If you listen a lot, you might hear her on other shows around the station.
What about Peter Lamborn Wilson?
When he comes into town, he might come in and make an appearance.
No, I doubt it very much, to tell you the truth.
I doubt it very much, but he does come into town.
He is somewhere in the Hudson Valley. I am not free to reveal the precise location and writing.
But is there, I didn't hear like the last shows you did with them, but did you part on unfavorable terms?
Totally, yeah.
Oh, it was. Okay, I didn't realize that.
Unfavorable terms?
No, on favorable terms.
Oh, you parted on favorable terms.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, oh, okay.
Did you say unfavorable? No.
Right.
No. We're all still friends.
Oh, okay. But yeah. There's no likelihood of the four of you getting back together to do like just a reunion program or of any type?
Well, there's an idea.
You never know what might happen.
You never know what might happen.
No, I think that would be really interesting.
It would be fun, but I think Peter would be very reluctant. And I think that Sharon is busy pursuing other things under other identities on other programs.
On BAI?
And that, other places.
Oh, other like non-commercial college type radio?
All over the place. Like I said, if you listen to the radio and you listen around, I'm sure you'll hear her voice.
Okay, stay tuned.
I'll have to look. All right, well,
stay tuned.
Do a great job.
Thank you.
Take care.
Thank you. Now, there's an old-time listener. How do you like that? There's somebody who's been on board with the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade for a very long time indeed. How flattering. We're able to actually hold somebody's attention for that many years. So have we found the... have we found this song?
Oh,
we can actually
take a
request like a real radio station.
Oh, it's
because we're almost out of time. We could take one more call.
Is this 16? It's the beginning of the second part of this record. Is that 16?
All right, let's see if we can figure it out.
What does it say?
That's the one he wants. We Are Normal. Yes,
somebody asked for that. That's 16. That's what
they
want.
Cut 16. Okay, well we'll go with that. Should we take one more call? Just for giggles, while I get this queued up. WBAI, you're on the air. No, I guess not. WBAI, you're on the air. Last chance.
Blackwood.
it's like a machine, you know. It just spits out that one word. Okay. Well, in that case, there's no disc in here.
It's already in the machine.
Oh, it's already in the machine. Oh, in that case, I didn't even have to. I didn't even have to kill time by engaging in that asinine little ritual. Cut number 14, is it?
16, isn't it?
Oh, 16, right, 16. Okay, we just wasted precious moments. Okay, here we are, taking requests like a real radio station, going out with the Bonzo Dog Band here on the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. See you next week. Say goodnight, Anne-Marie.
Goodnight.
Is this it?
It's supposed to be. It's not working.
And here comes some normals.
They look like normal Hawaiians.
Well, you didn't mention what much. Oh,
you think you're normal?
Yes, quite normal.
Okay, here comes one.
Well, it's not for me to deter, really, is it? I mean, it's for a psychiatrist to deter these things, isn't it?
They like their food, and they are very nice people.
Oh, it's all right, isn't it?
Fine.
Smart. Short back to side.
Well, it's like a rabbit. He's got a head on him like a rabbit.
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.